Well, good morning, and it's fantastic to be here in South Australia. I arrived back to Australia just 18 months ago or so, and I hadn't lived in Australia for 5 or so years. And I have to say that I've been to Adelaide since I've come back. It's my second trip, and that airport is absolutely sensational. You feel like you've... feel like Adelaide sort of... I walked past the old international airport, the little brown building, the one-story one, from the new one, and it feels like South Australia is a completely different place with that airport. So congratulations to the vision of building and opening a world-class airport. It was terrific, and you all who live here have much to be proud of. Today, I'm going to cover... Here we go. Today I want to cover an overview of the economic and financial prospects for 2006 as we see it from a banker's eyes, which is kind of scary, and sketching out the business environment that we see in front of us. And I think I'll draw out a few key messages about where I see there are opportunities and things that we need to watch out for. I encourage you all, please feel free at the end to ask any questions that you wish. On any topic except Aussie rules football, and particularly my team, Carlton Football Club. So no questions on them because they can't get worse than where they are right now. So I want to give you basically the answer, and then I'll give you my logic for the answer as we go through the next few slides. But basically, the bottom line is Australia is in great shape. And one of the things that really concerns me is that a lot of people seem to want to talk down the economy. I distinctly remember last year that around the time the Reserve Bank raised interest rates 25 basis points, I think it was around March 2005, we were and still are in really healthy shape as an economy with inflation pretty much under control. The economic environment was good, business confidence was quite strong, the world economy is moving along, and yet people kept saying, oh no, it's 13 years of economic prosperity, it must be going to turn down, and we're just waiting for it to happen. Well, one of the things that really concerns me is that if we all think it's going to happen, it will happen because our actions will cause it to be. And the reality from where we sat was that Australia is in fantastic shape. You'll see later on that we have everything in the world working for us. Now, there are some signs of some stress, yes, on the edges of what we're looking at, and we'll talk through some of those. But the bottom line is that when the stock market got a bit jittery in October 2005, you may all remember, I think it dropped 8 percentage points or so during that month. You speak to the analysts, they said, oh, earnings are going down, GDP softer, et cetera, et cetera. Well, yeah, GDP was softer. It wasn't 5%, it was 3.5%. And yes, earnings were not growing at 20%, they were growing at 10 or 15%. Well, I don't know about a lot of you, I mean, I'm relatively young, but I can distinctly remember 3 or so percent GDP was a ppretty damn good number. And 15% earnings growth was a pretty good damn number. And, you know, why people were panicking was ones that sort of surprised me. Those of you with vision, those of you with foresight, those of you with a real understanding of how the world works, took advantage of that opportunity and were laying down investments, building your organisation and taking it to another level. And I hope a lot of you took advantage of that. I think that's where we find ourselves in. Anyway, that's my advertising for my friend Peter Costello, and we'll go on here and have a look at the facts and give you some of our views that support that. So let's look at the world and what we're seeing around the world in a broad sense. And before we come back to Australia, because we need to understand the global context in which we find ourselves in, there is no question that the single biggest driver of global growth today is China. And there is no question that that the changes that we've seen in their consumption of commodities and the like, of some of the resources that come out of Australia, has significantly helped Australia in a global sense, be able to drive its GDP. Particularly the states of Queensland and WA have been significant beneficiaries of that, but we'll come back to that a little bit later on. The US, well, thank God that they love consuming in the US, and boy do I know that. Living in New York with a wife who managed to find out that there's no limit on my credit card because I work for the world's biggest credit card company, Citigroup, made sure that her alone, the US economy kept going. The last 4 years, it's been a very much a consumption-led growth in the US, and that consumption and the deficits they've been running have been a significant contributor to demand. What's been really terrific is, despite the high oil prices, the reason why we haven't had inflation and a serious economic downturn has been the export of deflation, essentially, by China. China unit prices have been going down due to very large excess capacity in China and very large manufacturing. And as prices get cheaper and cheaper, when they start exporting those goods, they've been having a natural offset against the rise of the oil prices. So this expansion that has occurred in manufacturing and the like industries in China has been a huge, significant boost to the US economy and quite frankly, the rest of the world. And it also has been quite helpful that India has done the same thing with its service sector, where the production of technology and services of the like have also been exported at a lower unit cost as time goes on. These have been very important global trends alongside the US. Now, for those of you that are interested in Asia, also Japan was even more interesting. Japan has been in Malay for now at least a decade, if not more, and they've had a serious economic situation occurring there. And there was a stage there when it was one of our biggest trading partners, and they're really sort of fading away. Well, if any of you have been watching the latest GDP numbers, there's a little bit of bright news that's occurred. If you took the October to December results and you annualise those, I think you get quite close to 3% GDP. And I can tell you, Japan hasn't seen 3% GDP in a long, long, long time. And I'm sort of reading some noises with their Reserve Bank equivalent, who is making some noises that the 0% interest rate policies of easy liquidity might be coming to an end. Now, this is a major change because one of the biggest plays for any financial market player has been borrowing in Japan at essentially zero and investing in the US and hedging out the results because of the government's play on currencies. It's been an easy way to make money for 5 years, and it looks like that easy money is about gone. The same in the United States, and I'll talk about that later on, which is the days of easy liquidity from the United States to keep the US economy going is just about over with their 4% or so interest rates today. Lastly, Europe, ex-UK, well, what can I say? They've been in the doldrums for a long time, and I think they're going to continue for a long time, and I think they've got real problems. The UK looks pretty good. If you see their GDP numbers, it's very much similar to Australia. They've had 12, 13 years of prosperity, and the economy looks pretty healthy and moving along in the right direction. So that's the global context of where the different economies as we see it today, and it's important to understand those relative to where we sit. I think the big issue is this gradual tightening. Right around the world, we've had 4 or 5 years of wonderful interest rates. They've been low, and they've been very accommodative to expansion. We didn't get inflation. Again, I gave my reasons earlier why we didn't, and we are very fortunate that that didn't happen. Because you know the old adage, right? When America twitches its nose, China sneezes, Australia gets pneumonia. Well, fortunately for us, occasionally when America is twitching its nose, China has been able to pass through that, and so have we. And I think the liquidity has been a really helpful thing for that. That's going to go away. So that means we should just now be careful, because if energy prices and other prices continue at their very high level, and you have high interest rates, and then you've got an over-leveraged consumer around the world where debt levels are at an all-time high, not just in Australia, but the UK and in the US, it means that if we do slip, it's going to hurt, and it's going to hurt big time compared to before. There are no signs that we're going to slip, but it does mean we are leveraged to that, and a word of caution needs to be had. Here are these GDP numbers that I was referring to earlier. I've given you back to 1980 the world numbers, which are running just short of 4%, primarily driven by non-Japan Asia. This is the Chinese economy and the Indian economies of the world running in the 7s and 8s, and China itself running into the close to 9s and 10s. And you can see the Eurozone down in the doldrums. And after the recession of 2001 that we experienced in the United States, there's been a terrific bounce back. We've given you a little bit of a forecast there, and there's nothing dramatic that we see that's going to turn downwards, but just a soft, gradual decline. Hopefully this is what it'll be, setting aside any kind of one-off terror activities or something else occurring that might make those forecasts invalid. You know, I'm going to give you some forecasts in the next few slides, and here's my word of caution. My first degree was in economics, and we were just talking about my professor who oversaw my thesis, a guy called Professor Glenn Withers, and he's a very bright man. He used to run EPAC many, many years ago, but he told me one thing, which is, whatever I say about the forecast as an economist, the only guarantee he'll give me is I'll be wrong. So I said, well, that's great. Why am I wasting my time here at university? But anyway, there'll be some here, and take those as you wish. But I'll try to give you at least a context that might try to create why this argument might hold. This is as a consequence of this global growth that we've seen, what's happening to commodity prices. You don't have to see this chart. You all know you can pick up the newspaper and see that oil is, $60 a barrel, and some of the other metals have also done incredibly well. We're not forecasting a dramatic decrease in the prices of many commodities, although we are going to experience a softening in some of those demand as some of the global GDP decreases that's in there. What's interesting about oil, I'll just give you one comment or one thought about oil, which is if you looked at oil prices, they tend to quote 1 month out. They're futures contracts. So they're 1 month prices out. They're not actually what's called the cash rate. They're the futures rate. And if you looked at supply and the availability on the spot market, the price is a lot lower. So what's being built into the futures market 1 month out is a significant and large premium versus what the actual demand supply availability is. I mean, it changes obviously daily what that is, but there is a significant premium. So what's been occurring is with all the political issues, the terror issues, the supply issues, whether it be Nigeria, Venezuela, Iran, Iraq, et cetera, a premium is built in to compensate for that, which hasn't occurred for a while. So therefore, what's really occurring is that essentially two sets of players are making a tremendous amount of money, the oil companies themselves, and some of you would have seen Exxon reported its quarterly profit of something like $8 billion profit after tax, US dollars, for the quarter. So they're doing all right. and the other people that are doing well are actual financial, hedge funds and the like, who are basically putting capital out and making the arbitrage between the actual and the futures. So anyway, we don't see anything changing that would cause a significant reduction. And the last thing is the Australian dollar and the implication for that. It's sitting in the order of around 73, 74 cents. And while we don't see, again, anything that's going to dramatically cause that to gyrate, we are forecasting it to slightly decrease with the softening of commodity prices. Okay, let's come to home and where we find ourselves. There's no question that the Australian economy has moderated from the very healthy GDP growth that we've experienced over the last 13 or so years since the recession of 91 and 92. Consumption growth definitely has slowed in the Australian economy and has been factoring into the GDP. The softening of house prices have also caused now a reduction in wealth and in spending power, which has henceforth reduced consumption growth. Although some of the income tax cuts, be it as small as they were, have helped, that occurred last year and the year before, and I suspect that our Treasurer is under a lot of pressure to give some of, further of the surpluses in terms of income tax cuts, and that will support the GDP numbers out for the next 12 months. Now, the one thing I would say just before I move into the business side of things is that, as he knows, this is a very delicate line he's got to run. If he drops taxes too much, especially at the lower end, you know, from a social perspective, that helps get you votes and it's good for the common person. The problem is, as some of you well know, is that at the lower end of our wealth effect is that people spend 110% of what they got. And it will be immediately spent. And the issue is if that's immediately spent as a tax reduction, it may stimulate inflation. If it stimulates inflation, the Reserve Bank will have no choice but to raise interest rates. If they raise interest rates, house prices will be under serious pressure and there will be, I think, a decline in our economy, and it's going to then hurt the people that the tax cuts were there to help. So that's my argument against dropping taxes for the common person, because I think within 1 or 2 years it is going to hurt us and hurt us big time, because our consumers in Australia are very leveraged to real estate. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. Let me give you a fact. In 1993, the total debt against real estate investment properties, not your own home, but against real estate investment properties, there was approximately $30 billion of debt in the Australian economy. And credit card debt was about $10 to $15 billion. Today, real estate investments, debt levels are $170 billion, and credit card debt is about $30 billion. Credit card debt is not the issue in this country. The total debt that consumers have in this country is approximately $650 billion. Credit card debt is less than 5%. Unlike in the US, where it's a really serious issue, here, credit card debt is just in the newspapers a lot because it's an easy thing to write and it's an easy one for people to speak about, but it's actually not the issue. The issue is the amount of debt against real estate investments, which is at an unprecedented level. The amount of debt against your first mortgage for home buyers has moved only with the rate of the economy. It hasn't changed as a percentage very much. This is the single biggest trend. And because we're so leveraged against real estate investments, changes in interest rates really matter. So if people say inflation doesn't matter and stimulating the economy doesn't matter, they don't know what they're talking about. We are at a very serious position, and this is one that I know our Treasurer is absolutely focused on and is conscious of. Personally, let me give my agenda on this one, so I'll declare what it is. I would much prefer to see the surpluses given back in a way that stimulates savings for our economy, and the best way to do that is to cut taxes altogether on superannuation. We've already got rid of the excess tax. I'd get rid of the other 15% tax and encourage people to put money away and encourage business to increase the amount of superannuation, encourage people to put long-term savings. This actually delivers the surpluses back to individuals. It's very equitable across our society because, you know, the RBL will stop the rich from overusing this point. And it delivers savings to people, money in their pocket, without stimulating inflation. So anyway, that's my personal bit, and I'll declare that and I'll call that out. but I do think it is a critical issue for our economy. So back to where I was on the GDP and the consumption side. What's happened in Australia is something very dramatic in the last 18 months, which is the GDP, which is running at approximately 3%, has completely changed its composition, why it's running at around 3%. It used to be run at 3% because of consumption-led, housing-led, real estate-led elements. It's now being driven by business credit. Business investments is now the primary driver of our GDP, which is great news. So businesses investing, they're growing, and they're building up stock and inventory, and consumption demand has moderated, and I think that's actually a very good thing. But business can't keep doing that into infinity without then consumption coming through to take up that production, or we export it. I'm not even going to try to show you this slide, but all I wanted to do was to point out to you that line, the red solid line, highlights the very healthy economy. The red line, not the dotted one, the solid red line, the average of the last decade or so. The main thing to take away from this slide is the real GDP looks like it's actually ticking up. Looks like it's ticking up in the Australian economy back towards the long-term trends of around the 3% to 3.5%. But this one is actually slightly more interesting, and I'll bring it back to South Australia. We at the National Australia Bank, or NAB, whichever one you like to call us. Oh, by the way, did you notice our new branding? If you haven't seen them at the bus shelters, here it is here. we do this survey with our business customers all over Australia. And what we do is we take a confidence and condition levels of our underlying customers. Because the NAB, right around Australia, we have the highest market share in business banking. We have something like one in four SME customers bank with us. And secondly, we have one in three farmers that bank with us. We get to obviously understand their business, and we do a survey of how their business is going. So it's an interesting survey of the underlying businesses, and we also do a survey of how the bankers who service them, how they're feeling or what their customers are telling them. And we get this information on a monthly basis to help us understand how the economy is tracking and where our exposures are. But what this is suggesting across Australia, and I've shown you here South Australia as a reference point, is that obviously mining is booming and we're doing quite well. Manufacturing is weak. Retail is dead across Australia. If you want to know the sector that's really being hit, there are two sectors that are being really hit, retail and transportation. They are in very, very difficult position. And it's no different to here in South Australia, although I don't see a green bar, which I'm assuming means zero, so it's really dead. Wholesale is different. Wholesale is also suffering across Australia, but not here in South Australia as much. And the fantastic transport, utilities and communication sector is doing well in South Australia, and then you can read the rest. The one I want to go to is the construction one. My analysis here is suggesting that Adelaide and South Australia haven't participated in the real estate boom in the same way as some of the other states have. Now, there's good and bad news in that, because the real estate creates wealth, which allows consumers to spend. But on the other hand, New South Wales has been in a lot of trouble in the last 12 to 18 months, mainly because they've got indigestion from the previous 5 years of construction activities that occurred. But anyway, that's an interesting one to see where South Australia is vis-a-vis the rest of Australia. Now, this is a long-term survey, and this is the one that goes back to 1990 that I mentioned earlier about the business conditions for Australia as a whole. And this is giving you a trend of where we find ourselves. What you can see is since the recession of 91-92, Australia has gone from negative right through to a positive business conditions. Basically, anything above zero is positive, anything below zero is negative. And what you can see, what's important here is the trend. And South Australia was moving in there. But look what happened since the blip of 2000-2001. South Australia has generally reported significantly better than average performance over the last 3 or 4 years. The South Australian economy is in great shape. And this indicates that it's the conditions of business are better than the average of the rest of Australia. Now, what's slightly alarming, although I don't know if it's a blip, is the very recent indicators that we've gotten on South Australia. You can see right at the end of this graph here that it's come off some highs of early 2005, late 2004, and has been trending down to now being slightly below the national average. So I don't know if that's just, you know, a blip in the statistics, which is quite possible, or whether there's a trend there that's emerging that one needs to watch out for. You all live here, you all know, you all run businesses, you all know better than I, but I'm just showing you the statistics. This is probably the most important graph that if you want to know what a banker looks at in order to assess the health of the economy looking forward. Unemployment is one of the most important indicators of what happens. You can track unemployment and look at a bank's profitability, and they are almost identical. It's a leading indicator of how banks do, and I think a lot of other businesses do as well. And there's no question that our economy and the financial services industry have been huge beneficiaries of the halving of unemployment rates since 1995. And you can see that the fantastic trend that South Australia's had since 1995, where they were running at a 20 to 30% higher unemployment rate, to now being lower than the Australian average and lower than New South Wales. This is absolutely fantastic. But have a look at the black dashed line, which is both WA and Queensland. You could put that up there as well. And they are running at just around 4% unemployment levels. That is absolutely a full economy. And Western Australia and Queensland have been huge beneficiaries of the export boom that we've experienced. There's the forecast for unemployment, a slight rise up, reflecting the slightly lower consumption levels that we're seeing, but nothing to be alarmed about. So we see a small tick up in unemployment. I'm going to go to the chart around the interest rate chart. This is the cash rates. And the main message I wanted to deliver to you here is that it looks like the US has finally finished its interest rate increases. We think there might be two more, roughly 225 basis points increases. And then largely we're looking for a relatively benign period in terms of rises. Australia, we're expecting the Reserve Bank to be on hold for the foreseeable future. So we do not see cash rates rising. Now, the long end, which isn't governed by the Reserve Bank, will fluctuate around the band, and every time our governor wants to slow things down, what he does is he talks them up. That's how he talks them up. He doesn't actually raise them. He just talks up the long end and threatens us. And he does that to ensure that we don't become too excited and start buying real estate again. And he's done a pretty good job at that. So we're expecting a relatively flat interest rate environment over the next 12 to 24 months. So I don't know if any of you agree or disagree with that, but that's how we see it. Okay, I'd like to just pause here for a few seconds and talk about what can go wrong with this relatively benign picture of the world, healthy, good growth, and one that we see is happening. So this is where now I put all my caveats, so none of you can say, well, he told us it was good and the end of the world came. So these are my caveats, okay? Assuming that none of these go wrong, then I'll be right. I forgot to write the bottom here and everything else, all other things. But a couple of those things that are pretty obvious, which is some of these emerging markets that are coming up like India and China. I mean, you know, they are absolutely doing great, but they're politically still not that stable. You know, the Pakistan-India thing, one day it's a problem, the next day it's not. And you just don't know. Who knows what's going to happen to Indonesia, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a serious issue and one that Look at the unbalanced world, I spoke about that. You know, we're relying on the US consuming tremendously. I don't know about you, but I just can't see how they can keep doing that indefinitely. At some stage, I've got to pay that money back. I remember when I first joined Citigroup in 2000, I was initially actually reporting to Bob Rubin, who was the former Treasury Secretary for Bill Clinton. And before that, he was at Goldman's. And he said to me that at the time of him leaving office, now you've got to remember, he's the guy who talked Clinton into going into, you know, positive budgets and all this kind of stuff and get out of the deficit stuff. So he's a very anti-deficits guy. But he said when they did their 20-year forecast for debt levels in the United States, they forecast a $12 trillion positive NPV of their future situation at the time he left being Treasury Secretary. 3 years later, he and I were having the same conversation, and the US deficit had just come in at $417 billion, something or other. And I said to him, do you still have access to your guys in Treasury? He said, you know, it's interesting you say that. He said, the number they gave me recently was $12 trillion deficit NPV. It's exact $24 trillion turnaround in 3 years. And, I mean, it's all extrapolation and all that stuff, but that's how serious the situation is. And the US, there is no grand plan to get out of this situation. And as long as the Japanese and the Chinese keep wanting to bail them out, that's fine. But what if that stops? What if that stops? Geopolitical tension, we all know about that, the very high oil prices, and the global pandemic. I mean, this is, you know, the avian flu. Don't know if you heard, but they found a few dead birds in Indonesia. It's getting close, a little bit too close, and we don't even know if this Tamiflu thing even works. If this thing is as bad as people are saying it could be, the consequences, because it has no boundaries, could be quite large. And without being alarmist about it, it's one that a lot of businesses ought to be preparing some business continuity plans around and figuring out what do you do if this thing hits. So we've certainly been thinking about it, and within the NAB, we certainly have it as one of our top 10 risks and are planning ourselves around how to deal with this issue. And then lastly, the Anglo-Saxon property crash issue, which is property prices are at an all-time high. Small interest rate changes could actually cause real estate to drop significantly. So anyway, there's some things that we're thinking about, I'm sure you have your own. When we look at Australia, just speaking of the property situation, it's quite interesting. We did our survey again of our bankers, and we asked them, do we have a housing bubble problem or not? And interestingly, we got as many people saying yes as no, roughly 50-50, that sort of sit there. But if you actually ask for what the price forecasts are, what you can see is that there's something between 0 to minus 5%, roughly, 0 to minus 5% is the expectations looking forward. Now, if that's what the extent of a housing decline is going to be, we don't have a problem. You will need something like a 20% property decline to have a serious economic problem. With this is as close to a soft landing as you're going to get. One of the reasons why real estate borrowings has been available and has made it easier is basically the low real interest rates. Interest rates have been so low and so attractive, it makes borrowing a lot easier. There's no question that wealth is much higher in our economy. The stock market's contributed to that, and real estate itself. And then thirdly, the competition in the housing lending market is absolutely intense. There are brokers everywhere trying to do deals, and they don't care what your ability to pay or not is. There's a plug for going with a bank, with a real bank. and they certainly have made competition very fierce. Margins in housing in Australia have gone from 400 basis points, 4%, down to 1%, and over 10 years. So competition has been good for the consumer by lowering the margin that banks make on lending money. So that's been good, but it has made this money cheaper for the consumer, henceforth driving higher debt levels. So there you go. Last couple of slides, and I'll finish off, is that this is very hard to read, but this is that our bankers, what their views are, and they still see out there in the economy basically availability of labour, which is the first set of charts. This is from July 04 to December 05, as still being an issue, especially in WA and Queensland. And certainly demand is starting to decrease. There's no question about that from the consumption line. There's something called other here. That spike is oil prices. So they're the things that were on the minds of some of our bankers overall. So let me finish off by just two things. One is talking about the NAB in South Australia and what we're seeing. Okay, just go here. The NAB in South Australia is led by Richard Hockney, who's here somewhere. Here he is on that table, who is our state chair and looks after our business banking and private banking. Anne-Marie Chamber looks after our retail business. And she's been here, I think, forever, right? One of the things that we've seen in South Australia for us is this enormous prosperity that's been created in the last 3 or 4 years. We've certainly participated with that. And for those of you who are our customers, can I just say thank you for being so. We've had some difficult times at the NAB over the last couple of years. In 2004. I will make one statement about it, which is anybody that thinks that our problems in 2004 was because of the 4X problem is surely misled. The problems the NAB experienced happened way before 2004 foreign exchange debacle. Losing $300 million is always a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of a company that's worth $50 billion, $300 million is not the issue. What it really brought out was a more serious issue about our company, which had been going on for a few years earlier, which is essentially an organisation that's well documented now, and I'm not going to go into it, but certainly an organisation that lost touch with its customers, lost touch with what matters, lost touch with the key things that drive the business, and that's the customers and looking after their staff. And so we became an arrogant organisation and we developed a culture that was very inwardly focused rather than outwardly focused. John Stewart, under his leadership, we're trying to change that. We're trying to build a culture that makes sense. We're trying to rebuild our relationship with the community and our regulators. That's why we went to lowercase NAB. Looks a little bit more friendly, a little bit more accessible. But more seriously, we're focused on the customer service and some of the efficiencies and processes that make life simple again for doing banking with us. We're putting more bankers back into branches and we're certainly doing that. Some of the customers in South Australia started to vote with their feet, and for 4 years we'd been losing customers, declining market share. The last 12 months, for the first time in a long time, market share is up a lot. And here in South Australia, under Richard's leadership, our market share has gone from 17% to 20%, which is a phenomenal turnaround. And also, Richard, under his leadership and his whole team, I'm so proud of what they've achieved, because not only is the market share number, but customer service is measured by the Roy Morgan surveys. We have the highest customer service rating for the NAB is here in South Australia. And that is a fantastic thing. That's an indicator I take very, very seriously in what we do. But we need to back up helpful bankers with processes and organisation that make it easy for the customer. So that's our next big way of doing things. So that's what I'd say to you about the NAB and the NAB in South Australia. The numbers in terms of growth are very impressive, but for those of you who are with us and have stuck with us, I thank you very much for that.